with Papua New Guinea? Why does a quarter of the world's population belong to the British Commonwealth and enjoy, to one degree or another, English common law and Westminster parliamentary traditions? Because in the early 19th century, the first nation to conquer infant mortality was England. Hitherto, the British Isles had been like the rest of the world. You had a big bunch of kids, and a lot of them died before they could be of economic benefit to you or to society. But by 1820, medical progress and improvements in basic hygiene had so transformed British life that half the population was under the age of 15. In sheer numbers, the country was still a pipsqueak cluster of North Atlantic islands with 28 million people, compared to China's 320 million. But it was the underlying demographic trend that proved decisive in the century ahead. Britain had the surplus manpower not just to settle Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, but also to provide the administrative and business class in the West Indies, Africa, India, and the Pacific. And, fortunately for the world, this demographic transformation occurred in a culture that even then had a long-established system of law, property rights, and personal freedom. Imagine what the planet would look like if the first country to conquer infant mortality had been a country with a less sustained tradition of individual liberty. China, say, or Japan, or Russia, or Germany. The what, where, and when are important, but the who is critical. It's hard to have a big influence in the world when there's just a few of you, and you're all getting on in years. So who's in the situation of England at the beginning of the 19th century? What country today has half its population under the age of 15? Spain and Germany have 14%, the United Kingdom 18%, the United States 21%, and Saudi Arabia has 39%, Pakistan 40%, and Yemen 47%. Little Yemen, like Little Britain 200 years ago, will send its surplus youth around the world, one way or another. Cultural relativists who sneer at the idea of English civilization should try to imagine what the world would be like if the U.S. Supreme Court and the Indian Parliament and the Australian legal system, not to mention Harvard and Yale, Oxford and Cambridge, had been built on Yemeni values. The state of our civilization manifests itself both in the non-problems that terrify us beyond all reason, rising sea levels, and in the real problems we pay no heed to. So David Remnick, editor of the famously fact-checked-to-death New Yorker, declares to the magazine's readers that the Earth will likely be an uninhabitable planet. In reality, much of the planet will be uninhabited long before it's uninhabitable. Yet environmentalists couldn't be less interested in the politics of people, people who need people. Pacey, Barbara Streisand, they're the unluckiest people in the world, as we're about to find out. When my second child was born, a neighbor said, "Well, you've got two. You can stop now." She was being enlightened and responsible. After all, for her entire adult life, the progressive-minded have worried about overpopulation. And this view became so pervasive that, in an age of hysteria about dwindling resources, it became entirely normal to look on our greatest resource, us, as a liability. So today, we're the dwindling resource, not the oil. We're the endangered species, not the spotted owl. The population explosion is a prop of the Western progressives' bizarre death cultism. We are so bad, so polluting, so exploitative, so violent, so destructive, that we owe it to the world not to be born in the first place. As Dr. Sue Blackmore wrote in Britain's Guardian, in an unintentional side-splitter of an enviro-doom column, "In all probability, billions of people are going to die in the next few decades. Our poor, abused planet cannot take much more. If we take the unselfish route and try to save everyone, the outcome is likely to be horrific conflict in the fight over resources, and continuing devastation of the planet until most or all of humanity is dead. If we decide to put the planet first, then we ourselves are the pathogen, so we should let as many people die as possible so that other species may live, and accept the destruction of civilization and of everything we have achieved. Finally, we might decide that civilization itself is worth preserving. In that case, we have to work out what to save and which people would be needed in a drastically reduced population, weighing the value of scientists and musicians against that of politicians, for example. On the one hand, Dr. Sue Blackmore and the bloke from Coldplay. On the other, Dick Cheney. I think we can all agree which people would be needed. Al Gore, the board of the Sierra Club, perhaps Scarlett Johansson in a fur-trimmed bikini, paddling a dugout canoe through a waterlogged Manhattan, foraging for floating curly endives from once fashionable eateries. Curiously, those environmentalists calling for a dramatically smaller population never seem to lead by example, and always manage to give the impression that no matter how small the ark is, they're a shoe-in for a first-class stateroom. But as it happens, Dr. Blackmore won't have to worry about whether to sacrifice Jacques Chirac and Vladimir Putin in order to save Sting and Bono. Given the plummeting birth rates in Europe, Russia, Japan, etc., a large chunk of the world has evidently decided to take preemptive action on climate change and opt for societal suicide. The crisis we face today is the precise opposite of overpopulation. The developed world's population is shrinking faster than any human society not in the grip of war or disease has ever shrunk. Does the environmental movement sicken itself only over the black rhino and the green-cheeked parrot? Aren't people part of the environment? They certainly have environmental implications. For one thing, there'll be far fewer environmentalists around. By the end of this century, the demographically doomed Italians and Spaniards will be so few in number, there won't be enough continental environmentalists left to man the local Greenpeace office. The Belgian climate change lobbyist will be on the endangered species list with the Himalayan snow leopard. And from an American point of view, the blue state ecochondriacs of Massachusetts and California will be finding the International Sustainable Development Conferences a lot lonelier. As for the merits of scientists and artists over politicians, those parts of the world still breeding are notable for their antipathy to music, haven't done much in the way of science for over a millennium, and politics-wise, incline mostly to dictators and mullahs, nuclear or otherwise. Scrap Scarlett Johansson's fur-trimmed bikini and stick her in a waterlogged burqa. Most 20-year projections on economic growth, global warming, etc., are laughably speculative, and thus most doomsday scenarios are too. The eco-doommongers get it wrong because they fail to take into account human inventiveness. "We can't feed the world," they shriek. But we develop more efficient farming methods with nary a thought. "The oil will run out by the year 2000," they warn. But we develop new extraction methods and find we've got enough oil for as long as we'll need it. But human inventiveness depends on humans, and that's the one thing we really are running short of, at least in the self-flagellating developed world. The West runs out of stock. Take an alphabetical list of nations of the world and start at the beginning. 1. Afghanistan. In 2005, the rate of births per 1,000 people in the country was 47.02. 2. Albania. In 2005, the rate of births per 1,000 people in the country was 15.08. That means Albanians are breeding at a third of the rate of Afghans. As noted above, replacement fertility rate, that is the number you need for merely a stable population, not getting any bigger, not getting any smaller, is 2.1 babies per woman. Some countries are well above that. The global fertility leader, Niger, is 7.46, Mali, 7.42, Somalia, 6.76, Afghanistan, 6.69, Yemen, 6.58. Notice what those nations have in common? Starts with an I, ends with a slam, as in slam dunk. Go back to that Albanian fertility rate. It looks low compared to Afghanistan, but it's the highest rate in Europe. And why would that be? Because it's Europe's only majority Muslim country, at the moment. Scroll way down to the bottom of the Hot 100 top breeders, and you'll eventually find the United States hovering just at replacement rate, with 2.11 births per woman. New Zealand's just below, Ireland's at 1.9, Australia 1.7. But Canada's fertility rate is down to 1.5, well below replacement rate. Germany and Austria are at 1.3, the brink of the death spiral. Russia and Italy are 1.2, Spain 1.1, about half replacement rate. So Spain's population is halving with every generation. Two grown-ups have a total of one baby, so there are half as many children as parents, and a quarter as many grandchildren as grandparents, and an eighth as many great-grandchildren as great-grandparents. And after that, there's no point extrapolating, because you're over the falls, and it's too late to start paddling back. I received a flurry of letters from furious Spaniards when the government decided to replace the words father and mother on its birth certificates with the less orientationally offensive terms progenitor A and progenitor B. This was part of the bureaucratic spring cleaning of traditional language that always accompanies the arrival in law of gay marriage. But with historically low numbers of progeny, the designations of the respective progenitors seem of marginal concern. No point renaming the teams if you no longer play the game. They might at least encourage young Spaniards to wander into Barcelona singles bars and try out the line, "Do you want to come back to my pad and play progenitor A and progenitor B?" Well, okay, but only if I can be progenitor A. Just as revealing, in 2006, Spain's ruling Socialist Party introduced a bill in Parliament legislating that apes be included in the category of persons, and that they be given the moral and legal protection that currently are only enjoyed by human beings. The party's argument was that human Spaniards do, after all, share 98.4% of their genes with chimpanzees, 97.7% with gorillas, and 96.4% with orangutans. Unfortunately, the 2% Spaniards don't share apparently includes the urge to reproduce. For the new Europe, instead of Gibbons decline and fall, maybe someone should write Gibbons rise and triumph. But why stop there? Why not give sheep the right to an abortion, or allow gerbils to contract gay marriage with a cockatoo? Why does the King of Spain not simply declare that henceforth, by royal proclamation, pigs shall fly? By 2050, Italy's population will have fallen by 22%, Bulgaria's by 36%, Estonia's by 52% or more. 17 European nations are now at what demographers call lowest low fertility, 1.3 births per woman. In theory, those countries will find their population halving every 35 years or so. In practice, it will be quicker than that, as the savvier youngsters figure there's no point sticking around a country that's turned into an undertaker's waiting room. Not every pimply burger flipper wants to support entire old folks' homes, single-handed, and, aside from the economic argument, there are cultural factors, too. I love going into Viennese record stores, where the main floor is full of waltzes and operetta, and the hip-hop section's one tiny bin down in the back of the basement. But if you're young and fancy a burg with more of a buzz on the cutting edge of the zeitgeist, you're unlikely to find it in Western Europe circa 2020. As for America, Demographic trends suggest that the blue states ought to apply for honorary membership of the EU. In the 2004 election, the Bush-voting states had fertility rates 12% higher than Kerry-voting states. Barring a sudden change in electoral fortunes, Democrats are going to be even more depressed after the 2010 and 2020 reapportionments. Those who poo-poo the United States' comparatively robust demographics say they reflect nothing more than the fecundity of Hispanic immigration. It's the legions of the undocumented who are filling the maternity wards. In fact, white women in America still breed at a greater rate, 1.85 or so, than white women in Europe or Canada. And from the Democrats' point of view, as they preside over dwindling school enrollments from San Francisco to rural Vermont, the reality is that red state white Americans breed above replacement rate. In demographic terms, the salient feature of much of the progressive agenda, abortion, gay marriage, endlessly deferred adulthood, is that whatever the charms of any individual item, cumulatively, it's a literal dead end. As fertility dries up, so do societies. Demography is the most obvious symptom of civilizational exhaustion and the clearest indicator of where we're headed. These countries are fading to oblivion unless they can change their ways or train those orangutan citizens to serve the food at the seniors' community center. The tax revenues that support the ever-growing numbers of the elderly and retired have to be paid by equally growing numbers of the young and working. The design flaw of the radically secularist utopia is that it depends on a religious society birth rate. So, if Europeans and Canadians can no longer be bothered to have children, where's that workforce going to come from? Easy, say the complacenics at Toronto's Globe and Mail. In 2004, reacting to the lowest Canadian fertility rate since records began, and a 25.4% fall since 1992, the Globe's editorialists wrote, "Luckily for our future economic and physical well-being, Canada is well-positioned to counter the declining population trend by continuing to encourage the immigration of talented people to this country from overcrowded parts of the world." Phew! So there's nothing to worry about, eh? Thank goodness for that. Canadians can all go back to sleep while reading the Celebrate Diversity booklet from the Department of Multiculturalism. But hang on a minute. Talented people from overcrowded parts of the world? Okay, name some. The experts of the Western world are slower to turn around than an ocean liner. And in Europe, they were still yakking about the population explosion, even as their 1970s schoolhouses, built in anticipation of traditional Catholic birth rates, were emptying through the 90s and aughts. In the ne plus ultra of Doomsday Tracts, The Population Bomb, 1968, Paul Ehrlich begins with a blithely snobbish account of trying to reach his hotel in Delhi through the teeming hordes of humanity. People eating, people washing, people sleeping, people visiting, people arguing and screaming. People thrust their hands through the taxi window, begging. People defecating and urinating. People clinging to buses. People herding animals. People, 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 people. But in the 21st century, even Delhi's running out of people. Even Paul Ehrlich's hellhole of choice doesn't have a high enough birth rate to maintain its population in the long term. Yet the complacenics cling to the long-held Euro-Canadian policy of using the Third World as a farm team and denuding developing societies of their best and brightest. In the 2004 election, John Kerry and John Edwards made a big hoo-ha about outsourcing, that is, American companies setting up a customer call center in Ireland or India. Outrageous. Yet most of the West has outsourced its entire future to the Third World. Just as America relies on the Chinese to make cheap Elmos and Poos, so Canada relies on them to make cheap human beings, the children that domestic manufacturers in Canada, Europe, and elsewhere have concluded are prohibitively expensive to produce at home. Personally, I've never seen what's so liberal and enlightened, rather than lazy and selfish, about fleecing the third world of its doctors and engineers. But even if you approve of it, it won't be an option much longer. The UN's most recent population report has revised the global fertility rate down from 2.1, that is, replacement rate, to 1.85, that is, eventual population decline. World population will peak in about 2050, I'd hazard earlier, and then fall. For Europeans too self-absorbed or overtaxed to breed, the fallback position for their own barrenness, use the third world as your nursery, is also dead. Post-Christian hyper-rationalism turns out to be, in the objective sense, a lot less rational than Catholicism or Mormonism. Indeed, in its reliance on immigration to ensure its future, the European Union has adopted a 21st-century variation on the strategy of the Shakers, who were forbidden from reproducing and thus could increase their numbers only by conversion. Birth rates in the so-called overcrowded parts of the world are already 2.9 and falling. India has a quickly growing middle class and declining fertility. In 2020, talented people will be much sought after by all countries within the developed but depopulating world. How sure can Canadians be that an educated Indian will prefer a high-tax, low-temperature jurisdiction to America or Australia? Or, come to that, to his own economically booming country, where the fruits of his labor won't be shoveled straight into paying the debts run up by the wheezing boomers. The third worlders being born now, in all but the most psychotic jurisdictions, will reach adulthood with a range of options. By 2015, a smart, energetic Chinaman or Brazilian will be able to write his own ticket anywhere he wants. How attractive will the prospect of moving to the European Union and supporting a population of geriatric ingrate continentals be? If that ratio of workers to retirees keeps heading in the same direction, the EU will have the highest taxes not just in the Western world, but in most of the rest. A middle-class Indian or Singaporean or Chilean already has little incentive to come to the continent. If the supposedly insane neocon plan to remake the Middle East comes off, even your wacky Arabs may stay home. East meets West. There is no population bomb. There never was. Even in 1968, Paul Ehrlich and his ilk should have understood that their so-called population explosion was really a massive population adjustment. The world's people are a lot more Islamic than they were back then, and a lot less Western. Islam is the fastest-growing religion in Europe and North America. In the United Kingdom, more Muslims than Christians attend religious services each week. Meanwhile, in areas of traditionally moderate Islam, from the Balkans to Indonesia, Muslims are becoming radicalized and fiercer in their faith. If a society chooses to outsource its breeding, who your suppliers are is not unimportant. I've heard those very silly remarks made about immigrants to this country since I was a child, said Lynn Allison of the Australian Democrats, after a political opponent, Dana Vale, warned that the country could be swamped by Muslims. If it wasn't the Greeks, it was the Italians, or it was the Vietnamese. But those are races or nationalities. Islam is a religion, and an explicitly political one. Unlike the birthplace of your grandfather, it's not something you leave behind in the old country. Indeed, for many of its adherents in the West, it becomes their principal expression, a pan-Islamic identity that transcends borders. You can't find any equivalent in Italian or Greek or Lebanese or Chinese or Baltic immigration to Australia. There is no equivalent of raving on about jihad, said the Aussie Prime Minister, John Howard, stating the obvious in a way most political leaders can't quite bring themselves to do. There is really not much point in pretending it doesn't exist. Islam is now the principal supplier of new Europeans, and currently the second biggest supplier of new Canadians. So it's worth mulling over the question John Howard suggests. What proportion of Western Muslims is hot for jihad? 5%? 10? 12? 20%? The years roll by since September 11th, and for the most part, we are none the wiser. Nonetheless, except for the willfully blind, the distinctions between Ms. Allison's Greeks and Italians and Vietnamese and Muslim immigration are clear. Instead of a melting pot, there's conversion. A Scot can marry a Greek or a Botswanan, but when a Scot marries a Yemeni, it's because the former has become a Muslim. In defiance of normal immigration patterns, the host country winds up assimilating with Islam. French municipal swimming baths introduce gender-segregated bathing sessions. Australian hospitals remove pork from the cafeteria menu. It's fair to point out that in much of the West, Western civilization has been only recently acquired. Until the 1970s, Southern Europe was mostly dictatorships: Portugal, Spain, Greece. A generation earlier, Italy was a gangster state, and Germany a genocidal one. The Muslim critique of the West, that we're decadent, vulgar, narcissist, fornicating sodomites, is not without more than a grain of truth. But when the fastest breeding demographic group on the planet is also the one most resistant to the pieties of the social democratic state, that presents a severe challenge, at least for the left. In their bizarre prioritization of a woman's right to choose, feminists have helped ensure that European women will end their days in a culture that doesn't accord women the right to choose anything. Non-Muslim females in heavily Muslim neighborhoods in France now wear headscarves while out on the streets. Yes, yes, I know Islam is very varied, and Riyadh has a vibrant gay scene, and the Khartoum Feminist Publishing Collective now has so many members they've rented lavish new offices above the clitorectomy clinic. I don't pretend to have all the answers, except when I'm being interviewed live on TV. But that's better than pretending that there aren't even any questions. Forget the Jews and the gays and the women, and reduce it to its most basic. In most Muslim jurisdictions, there is simply no culture of inquiry. No notion that challenging, questioning, testing the assumptions of that society has any value. This isn't a recent development. For Islam's first two or three centuries, scholars busied themselves figuring out what the divine revelations of the Quran actually meant for the daily routine of believers. But by the 11th century, all four schools of Islamic law had concluded they were pretty much on top of things, and there was no need for any further interpretation or investigation. And from that point on, Islam coasted and then declined. The famous United Nations statistic from a 2002 report, more books are translated into Spanish in a single year than have been translated into Arabic in the last 1,000, suggests at the very minimum an extraordinarily closed world. What books are among the few they do translate? Mein Kampf and The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, both of which are prominently displayed bestsellers in even moderate Muslim countries, and indeed even in the Muslim stores on Edgware Road in the heart of London. No Islamic nation could have flown to the moon or invented the internet, simply because for a millennium the culture has suppressed the curiosity necessary for such a venture. You don't have to subscribe to the view that every Muslim is a jihadist nutcake, eager to hijack a 747 and head for the nearest tall building, to acknowledge that at the very minimum, these population trends put a large question mark over the future. Let me pluck two interesting numbers. In the fall of 2001, the Ottawa Citizen conducted a coast-to-coast survey of Canadian imams and found all but two insisting that there was no Muslim involvement in September 11th. Oh well, it was just a few weeks after the attacks. Everyone was still in shock. Perfectly understandable in its way. 5 years later, in the summer of 2006, a poll in the United Kingdom found that only 17% of British Muslims believed there was any Arab involvement in September 11th. Anyone who's traveled in the Middle East will recognize that moment, not with the wacky death to the great Satan guys, but with the hot-looking westernized Bahraini lady doctor you're enjoying a little incendiary flirting with. And then, 10, 20, 45 minutes into the conversation, she says something nutty. Often what's nuttiest is that it's completely illogical. In the spring of 2002, I met many Arabs who believed simultaneously that A, September 11th was pulled off by the Mossad, and B, it was a great victory for the Muslim people. What that British poll suggests is that the same syndrome is very advanced among Western Muslims. You can be perfectly assimilated when it comes to clothes, sports, pop music, the state of the economy, the need for transport infrastructure spending, and a million other issues. But on one of the central questions facing the world today, 83% of the fastest-growing demographic in the United Kingdom does not accept the same reality as their fellow British subjects. And competing versions of reality is never a good recipe for social stability. Western Muslims are playing their own 24/7 version of the children's game Opposite Land. So if a population at odds with the modern world, in Philip Longman's phrase, is the fastest breeding group on the planet, how safe a bet is the survival of the modern world? The principal challenge to the United States in the years ahead is to avoid winding up the lonesomest gal in town. Given that most of its old allies, the ones John Kerry places so much stock in, are unlikely to conjure up the will to save themselves, it's important that new allies are found among the emerging nations. I'm a supporter of the Bush Doctrine of bringing liberty to the Middle East. It's a long shot, but whatever their problems, most Islamic countries have the advantage of beginning any evolution into free states from the starting point of relative societal cohesion. By contrast, European nations face the trickier task of trying to hold on to their freedom at a time of cultural disintegration. Many of them won't make it. Watching the scenes of the anti-Danish protests on TV, as angry, implacable crowds march through the streets denouncing freedom as Western terrorism and pledging that the enemies of Islam would drown in their own blood. I thought back to those times I've been in the Arab world and rounded a corner and found something scary going on. Excitable men prancing around the streets doing the old death to the great Satan dance. In the Middle East, you quickly learn the art of backing out of the room without catching the crazy guy's eye. The problem for Europe is that it's their room the crazy guys are now in. The Seventh Age. A good way to look at what's happening is via Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and entrances. And right now, some of us are a lot closer to the exits, and some of us are still pouring through the entrances. Look at the bard's various ages. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like a pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. They are the foot soldiers of the jihad, the excitable young men you see on the news jumping up and down in the streets of Gaza and Islamabad, torching the stars and stripes. And also, and more important, the ones who take flight training so they can plow jets into skyscrapers, who take whitewater rafting breaks in Wales so they'll be at the peak of fitness when they self-detonate on the London Tube. The ones who define courage as the ability to look a 7-year-old Beslan schoolgirl in the eye and kill her. Full of strange oaths, seeking the bubble reputation in the cannon's mouth, or even the cannon's, canon's, mouth. The incendiary imam urging them on to martyrdom. Over the next generation, that population of excitable young men will explode. Demographically, I mean, though very literally if the more severe mullahs have their way. By 2050, Muslim fertility rates will be in decline, as they already are in some of the more developed Islamic countries. But they'll be beginning their decline much later than Europe's, or Canada's, or Vermont's, and so they will have a huge demographic advantage. And given that that's the sole advantage they'll have, the Middle East's only other resource, oil, will be a fast-evaporating pool by mid-century. This is Islam's demographic moment, and they have to make the most of it. If they're serious about the new caliphate and making the whole world part of the Dar al-Islam, they have to pull it off in the next quarter century. What of America? The hyperpower, demographically, is in Shakespeare's middle age. In fair round belly with good capon lined, full of wise saws and modern instances. Or, more accurately, divided between the two, blue staters taking refuge in too many modern instances, but with sufficient red staters who still live by the wise saws. The United States has demographic challenges of its own, but even if one accepts the dubious proposition that its population's ability to maintain replacement rate fertility is largely dependent on Hispanic immigration, its native birth rate is still the highest in the developed world. So the United States' relatively healthy demographic profile is merely the latest example of American exceptionalism. What of Europe? The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again towards the childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. That's the situation the continent's in. In constructing the European Union, they've built a world too wide for their shrunk shank. Worse, it's constructed in a particular fashion. Since 1945, the big manly voices of the perpetually warring Germans and French and Italians have been turned to socialized health care and welfare and paid vacations that enable modern European man to live his entire life in the childish treble. Unfortunately, such a society is hideously expensive to maintain. So Europe's aging population requires ever more and ever younger immigrants to prop up the system. How does Shakespeare conclude? Last scene of all that ends this strange eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. That's Russia today, the sick man of Europe, with falling life expectancy, riddled with HIV and tuberculosis and heart disease, its infrastructure crumbling, its borders unenforceable, and its wily kleptocracy draining its wealth westward. A nation all but sans everything. How does Shakespeare begin? At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Go to any children's store in Amsterdam or Marseille or Vienna or Stockholm. Look at the women in headscarves or full abaya. That's the future. Chapter 2. Going, going, gone. Demography versus delusion. Like a lecherous stud, suddenly stricken with impotence, we are humiliated at the very heart of our faith in ourselves. For all our knowledge, our intelligence, our power, we can no longer do what the animals do without thought. P. D. James, The Children of Men, 1993. The words are those of Theodore Farron, fellow of Merton College, Oxford, in the first chapter of Baroness James's novel, set in 2021, when the human race is unable to breed. We seem to be approaching that situation a little ahead of schedule. The only difference between Lady James's dystopian fantasy and our current reality is that, In the fictional version, man is physically impotent. In real life, we appear to be psychosomatically barren, at least in the non-red state parts of the developed world. Almost every geopolitical challenge in the years ahead has its roots in demography, but not every demographic crisis will play out the same way. That's what makes doing anything about it even more problematic. Different countries' reactions to their own particular domestic circumstances will impact in destabilizing ways on the international scene. In Japan, the demographic crisis exists virtually in laboratory conditions, no complicating factors. In Russia, it will be determined by the country's relationship with a cramped neighbor, China. And in Europe, the new owners are already in place, like a tenant with a right-to-buy agreement. Let's start in the most geriatric jurisdiction on the planet. In Japan, the rising sun has already passed into the next phase of its long sunset, net population loss. 2005 was the first year since records began, in which the country had more deaths than births. Japan offers a chance to observe the demographic death spiral in its purest form. It's a country with no immigration, no significant minorities, and no desire for any. Just the Japanese, aging and dwindling. At first, it doesn't sound too bad. Compared with the United States, most advanced societies are very crowded. If you're in a cramped apartment in a noisy, congested city, losing a couple hundred thousand seems a fine trade-off. The difficulty in a modern social democratic state is managing which people to lose. Already, according to the Japan Times, depopulation is presenting the government with pressing challenges on the social and economic front, including ensuring provision of social security services and securing the labor force. For one thing, the shortage of children has led to a shortage of obstetricians. Why would any talented, ambitious med school student want to go into a field in such precipitous decline? As a result, if you live in certain parts of Japan, childbirth is all in the timing. On Oki Island, try to time the contractions for Monday morning. That's when the maternity ward is open, first day of the week, 10 a.m., when an obstetrician flies in to attend to any pregnant mothers who happen to be around. And at 5:30 p.m., she flies out. So if you've been careless enough to time your childbirth for Tuesday through Sunday, you'll have to climb into a helicopter and zip off to give birth alone in a strange hospital, unsurrounded by tiresome loved ones. Do Lamaze classes on Oki now teach you to time your breathing to the whirring of the chopper blades? The last local obstetrician left the island in 2006, and the health service isn't expecting any more. Doubtless, most of us can recall reading similar stories over the years from remote rural districts in America, Canada, or Australia. After all, why would a village of a few hundred people have a great medical system? But Oki has a population of 17,000, and there are still no obstetricians. Birthing is a dying business. So what will happen? There are a couple of scenarios. Whatever Japanese feelings are on immigration, a country with great infrastructure won't empty out for long, any more than a state-of-the-art factory that goes belly up stays empty for long. At some point, someone else will move in to Japan's plant. And the alternative? In P.D. James's The Children of Men, there are special dolls for women whose maternal instinct has gone unfulfilled. Pretend mothers take their artificial children for walks on the street or to the swings in the park. In Japan, that's no longer the stuff of dystopian fantasy. At the beginning of the century, the country's toy makers noticed they had a problem. Toys are for children, and Japan doesn't have many. What to do? In 2005, Tomy began marketing a new doll called Yumel, a baby boy with a range of 1,200 phrases, designed to serve as a companion for the elderly. He says not just the usual things, I love you, but also asks the questions your grandchildren would ask if you had any. Why do elephants have long noses? Yumel joins his friend, the snuggling Ifbot, a toy designed to have the conversation of a 5-year-old child, which its makers, with the usual Japanese efficiency, have determined is just enough chit-chat to prevent the old folks going senile. It seems an appropriate final comment on the social democratic state. In a childish, infantilized, self-absorbed society where adults have been stripped of all responsibility, you need never stop playing with toys. We are the children we never had. And why leave it at that? Is it likely an ever smaller number of young people will want to spend their active years looking after an ever greater number of old people? Or will it be simpler to put all that cutting-edge Japanese technology to good use and take a flyer on Mr. Roboto and the post-human future? After all, what's easier for the governing class? Weaning a pampered population off the good life and reteaching them the lost biological impulse? Or giving the Sony Corporation a license to become the Clony Corporation? If you need to justify it to yourself, you'd grab the graphs and say, well, demographic decline is universal. It's like industrialization a couple of centuries back. Everyone will get to it eventually, but the first to do so will have huge advantages. The relevant comparison is not with England's early 19th century population surge, but with England's Industrial Revolution. In the industrial age, manpower was critical. In the new technological age, manpower will be optional. And indeed, if most of the available manpower is Muslim, it's actually a disadvantage. As the most advanced society with the most advanced demographic crisis, Japan seems likely to be the first jurisdiction to embrace robots and cloning and embark on the slippery slope to transhumanism. So perhaps the ever more elderly Japanese will go on, and on and on, like the joke about the gnarled old rustic and the axe he's had for 70 years. He's replaced the blade 7 times and the handle 4 times, but it's still the same old trusty axe. We will have achieved man's victory over death, not in the sense our ancestors meant it, the assurance of eternal life in the unseen world, but in the here and now, which is what it's all about, isn't it? An eternal present tense. Think I'm kidding? Compare the suspicion and demonization of genetically modified foods to what's mostly either enthusiasm for or indifference to genetically modified people. Mess with our vegetables, we'll burn down your factory. Mess with us, and we pass you our credit card. And by the time we wonder whether it was all such a smart idea, it'll be the clones who have the platinum Visa cards. If that creeps you out, there is a third option. Unlike the Europeans, many of whom will flee their continent as Utopia evolves into Eurabia, the Japanese are not facing ethnic strife and civil war. They could simply start breeding again. But will they? 51% of all Japanese women born in the early 1970s were still childless by their 30th birthday. Reporting the latest set of grim statistics, the Japan Times observed, almost en passant, Japan joins Germany and Italy in the ranks of countries where a decline in population has already set in. Japan, Germany, and Italy, eh? If the Versailles Treaty was too hard on our enemies, the World War II settlement was kinder, but lethal. Red sails in the sunset? Japan is the most benign example of demographic decline, a problem for the Japanese, but not for the rest of us. Elsewhere around the world, America is threatened by rival powers, not because of their strength, but because of their weakness. For one thing, a flailing, fast-declining power is less bound by maxims of prudence. Russia, for example, is in an accelerating vortex, and, for Washington and other interested parties, the question is what Moscow will try to grab onto in order to slow the descent. From a population peak in 1992 of 148 million, Russia will be down below 130 million by 2015, thereafter dropping to perhaps 50 or 60 million by the end of the century, a third of what it was at the fall of the Soviet Union. It needn't decline at a consistent rate, of course, but I'd say it's more likely to be even lower than 50 million than it is to be over 100 million. In fact, the worst projections show Russia falling to around 85 million by mid-century. The longer a country goes without arresting the death spiral, the harder it is to pull out of it. Russia has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, 1.2 children per woman, and one of the highest abortion rates. When it comes to the future, most Russian women are voting with their fetus. 70% of pregnancies are terminated. Alan C. Lynch of the University of Virginia recalls visiting the country when the American pro-life film The Silent Scream was shown on TV there. The film is very graphic and unsparing in its examination of the effects on the fetus, its object being to prompt in the viewer revulsion and disgust at the procedure. It turned out that more Russian women, wrote Professor Lynch, became more positively attuned to the idea after having watched the film. Instead of the baby's pain, Russian viewers noticed the clean hospitals, the state-of-the-art technology, the briskly professional doctors and nurses. Women marveled, wouldn't it be great to have an abortion in the West? After 7 decades of communism, the physical barrenness is little more than a symptom of the spiritual barrenness. The culture of death is having a ball at the other end, too. If you're a male born in Russia in 2000, you can expect to live 58.9 years. While its women folk have a life expectancy comparable to their American counterparts, sickly Russian men now have a lower life expectancy than Bangladeshis, not because Bangladesh is brimming with actuarial advantages, but because, if he had 4 legs and hung from a tree in a rainforest, the Russian male would be on the endangered species list. The decline in male longevity is unprecedented for a relatively advanced nation not at war, and with many attendant social and economic consequences. So far, in this first large-scale experiment on the dispensability of men, it appears that, pacey Gloria Steinem, fish do indeed need bicycles. Russia is the sick man of Europe, and would still look pretty sick if you moved him to Africa. There are severe outbreaks of viral hepatitis. Tuberculosis is the country's leading fatal infectious disease, with a proliferating number of drug-resistant strains. It has the fastest-growing rate of HIV infection in the world. In the first 5 years of the new century, more people tested positive in Russia than in the previous 20 in America. The virus is said to have infected at least 1% of the population, the figure the World Health Organization considers the tipping point for a sub-Saharan-sized epidemic. So at a time when Russian men already have a life expectancy that doesn't make it beyond middle age, they're about to see AIDS cut them down from the other end, felling young men and women of childbearing age, and with them, any hope of societal regeneration. By some projections, AIDS will soon be killing between 25% and 750,000 Russians every year. Along with those extraordinary rates of drug-fueled hepatitis C, heart disease, and TB, HIV is just one more symptom of what happens when an entire people lacks the will to rouse itself from self-destruction. Russia will become a nation of babushkas, unable to deploy enough young soldiers to secure its borders, enough young businessmen to secure its economy, or enough young families to secure its future. And, if its export of ideology was the biggest destabilizing factor in the history of the last century, the implosion of Russia could be a major destabilizer of this one. Iran's nuke program is merely one of the many geopolitical challenges to America, in which there's a large Russian component somewhere in the background. There are districts that are exceptions to these baleful trends, parts of Russia that have healthy fertility rates and low HIV infection. Of the country's 89 federal regions, 12 are showing substantial population growth. Any ideas as to which regions they are? Once again, starts with an I, ends with a slam. The allegedly seething Arab Street that the West's media doom-mongers have been predicting since September 11th will rise up in fury against the Anglo-American infidels remains as seething as a Westchester County cul-de-sac on a Wednesday afternoon. But the Russian Federation's Muslim Street is real and on the boil, and even its placid quartier have no reason to prop up the diseased Russian bear. So the world's largest country is dying, and the question is how violent its death throes will be. Most of the big international problems operate within certain geographic constraints. Africa has AIDS, the Middle East has Islamists, North Korea has nukes. But Russia's got the lot. A potentially African-level AIDS crisis and an Islamist separatist movement sitting atop the biggest pile of nukes on the planet. Of course, the nuclear materials are all in secure facilities. Probably. Russia is the bleakest example of misdirected worrying. There are too many people and too few resources. Exactly backward, poor old Russia is awash in resources, but fatally short of Russians. And, yet again, warm bodies are the one indispensable resource. What would you do if you were the fellows in the Kremlin? What assets have you got to keep your rotting corpse of a country as some kind of player? You've got nuclear know-how, which a lot of ayatollahs and dictators are interested in. You've got an empty, resource-rich eastern hinterland, which the Chinese are going to wind up with one way or the other. That was the logic behind the sale of Alaska. In the 1850s, Grand Duke Konstantin Nikolaevich, the brother of Alexander II, argued that the Russian Empire couldn't hold its North American territory, and that one day either Britain or the United States would simply take it. So why not sell it to them first? The same argument applies today to 2,000 miles of the Russo-Chinese border. In the ever-emptier Russian East, there are 16 million people and falling. In China, there are 1.5 billion, and they need to stretch their legs. China is resource poor. The Russian East contains 80% of that country's resources. Given that even alcoholic Slavs with a life expectancy of 56 will live to see Vladivostok return to its old name of Haishanwei, Moscow might as well flog it to Beijing instead of having it snaffled out from under. Facing extinction, Moscow doesn't have much to barter with, except dangling the Chinese an offer that could solve several of their structural problems. In fact, Russia might offer a solution to the People's Republic's most distinctive structural flaw, the most gender-distorted demographic cohort in global history, the so-called Guanggun, bare branches. Since China introduced its one-child policy in 1978, the imbalance between the sexes has increased to the point where in today's generation, there are 119 boys for every 100 girls. The pioneer generation of that male surplus is now in its 20s. Unless China's planning on becoming the first gay superpower since Sparta, what's going to happen to those young men? As a general rule, large numbers of excitable lads who can't get any action are useful for manning the nuttier outposts of the jihad, but not for much else. So, given Russia's own imbalance between sickly men of low life expectancy and long-lived, robust women, it's not hard to see some mutual advantage in a bilateral mass hookup for Slav women and Chinese men, even if the boys are a bit callow and the chicks somewhat long in the tooth. That's not the death whimper of their czarist communist dreams, most Russian nationalists would have predicted. But then they've never been shrewd assessors of their own defects. One reason why Al-Qaeda seriously thinks it can destroy the West is because it believes that in Afghanistan, it, and not the United States, brought about the downfall of the Soviet Union. It will be Russia's fate to have large chunks of its turf annexed by the Islamic world. and much of what's left fall to the Chinese. That's the danger for Washington, that most of what Russia has to trade is likely to be damaging to U.S. interests. In its death throes, it could bequeath the world several new Muslim nations, a nuclear Middle East, and a stronger China. In theory, America could do a belated follow-up to the Alaska deal and put in a bid for Siberia. But Russia's calculation is that sooner or later, we'll be back in a bipolar world, and that, in almost any scenario, there's more advantage in being part of the non-American pole. If a Sino-Russian strategic partnership has a certain logic to it, so, in a darker way, does a Sino-Russo-Euro-Muslim alliance of convenience. I get a surprising amount of mail from Americans who say, "Oh, we're too big a bunch of politically correct blue state pussies to kick Islam a butt." But fortunately, the Ruskies and the Chi-Coms have their own Muslim whack jobs, and they won't be as squeamish as us wimps when it comes to sorting them out once and for all. Maybe. One day. But right now, they figure the jihad is America's problem, and it's in their interest to keep it that way. Hence, Russo-Chinese support for every troublemaker on the planet, from Iran's loony president to Hugo Chavez in America's backyard. So a combination of factors is bringing about a remarkable event, the death of a great nation, not through war or devastation, but through its inability to rouse itself from its own suicidal tendencies. As Mrs. Thatcher likes to say, the facts of life are conservative. The nation that tried to buck those facts of life the most thoroughly is falling the fastest. Churchill didn't know the half of it. Russia is a vacuum wrapped in a nullity, inside an abyss. La Feuille Morte. Demographic origin need not be the final word. In 1775, Benjamin Franklin wrote a letter to Joseph Priestley, suggesting a mutual English friend might like to apply his mind to the conundrum the crown faced. Britain, at the expense of 3 millions, has killed 150 Yankees this campaign, which is £20,000 a head. During the same time, 60,000 children have been born in America. From these data, his mathematical head will easily calculate the time and the expense necessary to kill us all. Obviously, Franklin was oversimplifying. Not every American colonist identified himself as a rebel. After the Revolution, there were massive population displacements. If you've ever driven along the Loyalist Parkway east of Toronto to Kingston, you'll know that large numbers of New Yorkers left the colony to resettle in what's now Ontario. Some American Negroes were so anxious to remain subjects of King George III, they resettled as far as Sierra Leone. For these people, their primary identity was not as American colonists, but as British subjects. For others, their new identity as Americans had supplanted their former allegiance to the crown. The question for today's Europe is whether the primary identity of their fastest-growing demographic is Muslim or Belgian, Muslim or Dutch, Muslim or French. That's where civilizational confidence comes in. If Dutchness or Frenchness seems a weak, attenuated thing, then the stronger identity will prevail. One notes other similarities between revolutionary America and contemporary Europe. The United Empire loyalists were older and wealthier. The rebels were younger and poorer. In the end, the former simply lacked the latter's strength of will. Europe, like Japan, has catastrophic birth rates and a swollen, pampered elderly class determined to live in defiance of economic reality. But the difference is that on the continent, the successor population is already in place, and the only question is how bloody the transfer of real estate will be. If America's allies failed to grasp the significance of September 11th, it's because Europe's homegrown terrorism problems had all taken place among notably static populations, such as Ulster and the Basque country. one could make generally safe extrapolations about the likelihood of holding Northern Ireland to what cynical strategists in Her Majesty's government used to call an acceptable level of violence. But in the same 3 decades as Ulster's troubles, the hitherto moderate Muslim populations of South Asia were radicalized by a politicized form of Islam. Previously, formerly un-Islamic societies, such as Nigeria, became semi-Islamist, and large Muslim populations settled in parts of Europe that had little or no experience of mass immigration. You can argue about what these trends mean, but surely not that they mean absolutely nothing, which is what the complacents assure us. On the continent and elsewhere in the West, native populations are aging and fading and being supplanted remorselessly by a young Muslim demographic. Time for the obligatory "of courses." Of course, not all Muslims are terrorists, though enough are hot for jihad to provide an impressive support network of mosques from Vienna to Stockholm to Toronto to Seattle. Of course, not all Muslims support terrorists, though enough of them share their basic objectives, the wish to live under Islamic law.